So, good morning everyone, and welcome back to the lecture of virtual machines. Today, Professor Seidel is on a business trip, so you have to deal with me. So let's jump in. Last time we finished with this optimizations of closures, and now let's have a look at which optimizations we can do for tuples and lists. And here, if we have a look at the code C of a tuple, well, what do we observe there? That how is code V defined? For code V, we create first code C for all the tuple elements, and afterwards we perform just a make vec instruction. And if we would create a closure for this, this would not really benefit of that. Why that? Well, for a closure, we have to come up with a vector for the globals, and we more or less have to construct a function. And if we have a look at this small construct of this tuple, then it's not worthwhile to construct a function for this, because we more or less only have to have to create this vector, which we have to do anyway. So here, as an optimization, we say that the code generation of a closure is the same than if we perform code V. And similarly, if we have a look at the empty list, if we have a look at code V there, then we just come up with this constructor nil. So this is more or less just an atom, like a number, like 5 or something like that, where we said that we do not come up with a closure for just a small thing like a number. And here, the empty list, which is just a nil and an atom, therefore 2, we don't create a closure either. So here, code C is just the same as code V. And then, let's have a look at the cons operator. So here, how is code V defined? There, we emit first code C for the head of the list, and then we produce code C for the tail of the list. And then again, we just come up with a single constructor, this cons thing here, and creating a closure just for this constructor cons is not worthwhile either. So as an optimization, we come up with code C for this list creation is the same as code V for the same expression. Okay, so that's it so far for closures. Now let's have a look at another optimization. This is last calls. So this is something which we face this week in the tutorial too. So first of all, what is a last call? The definition of is the following, that a function application is called a last call in an expression E if this particular application could deliver the value for this expression. So then this function application is called a last call. And we can make use of this definition such that we say that a function is tail recursive if all the recursive calls are last calls. Then this is called a tail recursive function. So let's have a look at an example. Here we have an expression, and we observe that this expression is contained in this right-hand side expression. And there, it is a last call. Why that? If we look at it, this is the very last thing which you execute here on the right-hand side. And afterwards, you do not come up with further evaluations. So that means for this particular expression, so I mark it in yellow. So for this whole expression, this last call can deliver the value for that particular expression. Therefore, this one is called a last call. Now let's have a look at a second example where we have this application of F. Well, this occurs in the right-hand side expression here, but this is not a last call. Why is that not a last call? What can you think of? Why is this not a last call? So again, to our definition, a last call is a function application which might or which delivers the value for the whole expression. And why is this not a last call? Any idea? Yeah. Exactly. So the problem is that we still have a multiplication left here. So if we evaluate that function f applied to x minus 1, then we are not finished. We are not done. We still have to multiply this value with x. So the function application cannot deliver the value for this whole expression. So with whole expression, I mean the one here in yellow. So the whole thing on the right-hand side. The nice thing, what we might observe for last calls, is that we don't necessarily need a new stack frame. Since we know that no further computation has to be done for in this stack frame, we can reuse the old stack frame. And, well, that thing actually enables us to transform a tail or a recursive function into a loop. So we can always reuse the current stack frame. First of all, this saves space. So if we don't have to allocate new stack frames, this saves our space. And, yeah, of course, we want to make use of that. Okay, so let's have a look. How can we make use of this? So here we have an expression L, which is a last call. And we assume that this is a last call in a function f with k arguments. And what do we actually have to do here? Well, we first have to allocate, as usual, the arguments. So from E0 to EM minus 1. And then we have to evaluate the expression E prime in order to retrieve the actual function. And then, well, since we still do this inside the stack frame of F, we then have to deallocate the local variables of that function f. And also, the arguments of that function f. And then finally, we can execute the function which we retrieved by evaluating e prime. And here, the ordering is of this step 1 and step 2 is somewhat important. We cannot switch it over because, well, if we deallocate the local variables first and we would then evaluate the expressions EI, then we might already have lost the reference to local variables and we cannot evaluate them. Okay, so if we do it in that order, first we emit code for them, and then we deallocate all the local variables. So how does such a code scheme look like? We have code V here for that particular last call L, and we again, as usual, emit code for the arguments in from right to left. So we start with code C of EM minus 1 until E0, and then we go over and emit code for the actual function which we want to execute. And then we have introduced a new function, or a new, well, not function, a new instruction for our virtual machine. We have an instruction move here. And this instruction move actually does the thing which we wanted in step 2. This deallocates the local variables and the arguments which have been consumed. That means here, so it has two parameters. So the first the second parameter is how many stack cells should be moved. This is m plus 1. Why m plus 1? Well, we observe that we have, for this last call, we have m many arguments, and then, well, this plus 1 results from the function itself, so to whatever e prime evaluated. And the first argument, this r, well, this is actually how many positions it should be moved inside our stack. So this is actually, well, it's the stack distance. That means how many local variables we have. And then since we know it is a k-ary function, we also have to deallocate this k-many arguments here. And then, well, we are done. So we then can make reuse of our stack frame by just calling the instruction apply. Okay, so let's have a look at an example. So first, let's fix our address environment row. And yeah, you need to help me. So what is actually the variable x? We have an argument y. What else do we have? We have an h. We have a t. And we have also a variable r. So now, what is the address of this variable x? Any idea? So it's an argument. So it's not a global, so it needs the tag L, but at which address? At which address do the formal parameters start? Zero, yes, right. So the first formal parameter is address 0. Well, then we already know that this variable y is also an argument, so it's a local. But which address has this one? Sorry? Minus 1, exactly. So, okay. And then, well, we have this variable h here. And what address do we have there? What address has this variable h? So that's not a formal parameter, so it's just a local variable, which might be, yeah, here it is introduced by this pattern matching, but it could be also introduced by a let binding. And, well, that is the first local variable. So, well, it is at address 1. Okay, and then similarly for this variable t, again, it is a local variable. And, well, since it is not the first anymore, it is the second, so it is at address 2. So what is then left is the variable r. What address do we have there? At which address is this variable r? So you might think or have a look at this expression. So this r, is it somewhere bound in this expression? No. It's a free variable. Therefore, it must be a global. And since it is the only global or only free variable, it has to be at position 0. Okay? So this is our address environment. And now, let's start with this code. Well, if we have a look at this function, well, we start with a stack distance of 0. And since this is a function with two arguments, we have to use this test arg of 2. And then we can already begin with evaluating or emitting code for the body of this function. And there, well, we have this match instruction where we do a matching on this variable x. So we have to load this variable x. And there, well, we have a stack distance of 0. So this is 0 minus the address of x. And, well, the address is 0. So 0 minus 0 is 0. So we have a push log 0. And then we assume that we have here call by need semantics, so we have to do an eval. We evaluate it, and then we do a pattern matching on lists. That means we have to use this test list macro, where at the address capital A, we go on if the thing does not evaluate to the empty list. Okay, so let's continue. So here, if this test list macro does not find out that this is not the empty list, if it is the empty list, then we go on with this right-hand side of the first pattern, and this is just loading the variable y. So we have to use here, well, we have a stack distance of 0 there, and we want to access this variable y. And variable y is address minus 1. So 0 minus minus 1 is then resulting in this number 1. So we do a push log 1. Again, we have call by need semantics. So we have to evaluate it. And then we are already done, at least with this case, for the pattern match. And we can jump out of it. And we jump to this label B, where we perform a return 2. And, well, again, this is a binary function, so we have to make use of this return 2 there. Well, and in the other case, if it is not the empty list, we result at this label A. Well, and what do we do there? We have to emit code for this expression here. So this function r applied to t and h applied to y. So again, we have to evaluate the arguments from right to left. So first we have to evaluate or emit code for this small expression. And here we first have to push the reference of h on top of the stack. And there we have a stack distance of 3. And the h is at address 1. So we perform a push log 4. Ah, sorry. That's rubbish. I was too fast. So we have a stack distance of 2, and the address of H is this number 1. So we have 2 minus 1 is 1. So we have a push log of 1 there. And then we have to push the reference of this Y on top of the stack. And Y is at address minus 1. So we have 3 minus minus 1 is then 4. So we emit push log 4 here. And then we just have to make use of this macro cons, which will create this list there. So then the next instruction, we want to emit code for this T. We have to look it up. And, what address is T? T is a local at address 2. So we have to perform 3 minus 2 is 1. So we have to emit push log 1 there. And then finally, we have to load the variable R on top of the stack. And this is a global, so we just perform a push glob at address 0 is the variable R, so it is a push glob 0 there. And then again, we have call by neat semantics, we have to evaluate it. And now comes this new instruction, this instruction move here. And this has, again, 2 parameters. So the first parameter, we start with the second parameter is this number 3. Why this 3? On top of the stack, we have now the reference to the function object, and we have 2 references, which are the arguments. So again, this is this one and this beast, and this one are on top of the stack, and we want to reuse the current stack frame, so we have to move this stack cells down. And how many stack cells do we have to move them down? These are actually these 4 stack cells. And why 4? We said that we have to deallocate the whole stack frame. So this means we have to deallocate the local variables and the arguments. And what are the local variables? We have a stack distance 2 here. So these are the 2 local variables. And we also know that this function has 2 arguments, this x and y. So 2 plus 2 is 4. So we have to deallocate these 4 stack cells. And then we can continue as usual by calling apply. And that's it. So we are done. And we reuse the current stack frame. Now you might wonder why there is a slide 2 left here. And this slide 2, this is something which actually comes from the code generation scheme of this pattern match. But this slide 2 will be never ever executed. This apply thing here, this apply thing, executes the function, and that one will make use of the return address of the current stack frame. So it will jump back wherever it came from. But again, this slide 2, it will never ever be executed. This is just a leftover from our code generation scheme of this pattern matching thing. Okay, clear so far? Okay, so, we have used this move instruction but never really defined it. There is nothing special. Again, we assume that we want... That we want to move k many stack cells here from the top of the stack. We want to move it down. And how many positions do we want to move them down? These are these R many positions, which we want to delete or wipe out, and then copy over these k many cells from the top of the stack. And, well, how can you do this? Well, you can easily implement it either by a for loop or, well, if you have a more clever machine underlying, you might make use of a memcopy instruction or, well, how, it depends on how your stack is actually implemented. But this is just an easy way to do it. Yeah, I think there is nothing special for this move instruction. Okay, so then let's go over this with this thing. So we are done with this last call. So now let's have a look at the next topic where I want to introduce exceptions. So exceptions is probably a topic you already know from other languages like, well, Java, C++, and so forth. And, well, it's, well, we've already seen there that it's a kind of a useful extension of languages, so we also want to make use of that in our virtual machine here. So let's have a look at this small example. We have a recursive function, greatest common divisor, and there, well, in case that this x or this y, which are both two formal parameters, if they are less or equal than 0, then we want to raise an exception. And in all other cases, we have to emit code as usual, so there is nothing special. But what we observe here is this special thing, well, where we have this try clause. And, well, how should we read that? Well, whenever an exception is thrown, then in this try thing, well, it tries to execute this expression here on the right-hand side. And whenever there is an exception thrown, then this will be catched inside this with clause. And here, well, it's just the identity. So it's somehow similar to pattern matching. We bind the value to this variable z, and then we immediately return this variable z. If we think of a real, or well, not a real, but if we think of types here, then then for simplicity, we assume that that these raised exceptions, that their type of can be of any type. So here it is the case that this function returns a type of an integer, and also here we raise an exception where the value is also of a type integer. But this does not necessarily need to be the case. So the only thing which need to be the case is that this expression evaluates to a type which is the same expression, has the same type of that expression down here. So let's make a concrete example. Assume that we don't raise an exception here with the value 0, but we could raise an exception with the empty list. And then we cannot make use of the identity here, but then assume we just return 42 here. So then, again, the result type of this expression has type integer, and also this is of type integer, but the exception itself, it has a different type. Namely, here we have a list type, and then this one here has also a type list. Okay, so, well, that's the only difference here which we might think of if we have a look at these exceptions. And again, we assume that these exceptions can be of any type. So let's go on. Well, in order to implement these exceptions, we have to come up with additional information which we have to save. And therefore, we introduce an exception frame on the stack, which, where we will save all the relevant information once we have to handle the exception. And that's not all we have to do. Well, we also have to introduce a new special purpose register in our machine, namely this exception pointer, which points to the current exception frame on our stack. And well, what information do we actually want to keep in our exception frame there? Well, first of all, what is kind of important is the negative continuation address. That means this is the address once an exception has been raised while we actually want to continue execution of our code. Well, furthermore, for that one, we might also have a special global pointer, so we have to keep that one. And we have to make use of saving the frame pointer. And then, yeah, this is kind of interesting, we also have to keep the old exception pointer. Why do we have to keep the old exception pointer? Can you think of a scenario where this is important? So, well, we might have nested try clauses. So we might have a try of an expression, and inside this expression we can again have a try and a try and a try and so on. So if then we have somehow a chain of tries. And therefore, we always have to keep the old exception pointer, where if one of the tries is finished, then we jump back to the next try and so forth until we are done. Okay, so this is more or less the setup which we have to establish. So let's have a look at an example. We have an expression E here where we perform a try of an sub-expression E1 and we match it, the result, if there is an exception thrown, we bind it to this variable X and we then have to execute the expression E2. So,
sorry, question.
Yes.
We have to keep that chain, is what I think of when, for example, in Java you have a try catch block, and then inside, of course, you don't have to generate a new try catch for an expression that could throw the same exception. But in this case, wouldn't we always need a try and a with? And that's why an exception wouldn't be.
Well, let's go back one time. Here we assume, again for simplicity, that an expression can be of any type. So if we have nested try clauses, something like try something something, and then we have try something something, and then we have this with thing something something, and then we have the outermost with thing, then assume that an exception is thrown inside here, then the exception handler, we have to take this one. But once I mark it in but once this whole expression has been executed, then we have to restore in our register XP the continuation address of this particular try clause. So then we have to somehow go back into here.
Okay, just to restore the old jumping address.
Yes. No, no. Okay. Very nice question. So let's get back to our example here. So again, we want to emit code for this one here. And well, the first thing which we do is whenever our instructions so far are not, well, strong enough, then we introduce a new macro, and this is what we do here. So we have this macro try, and this macro try gets as an argument an address, and this is the negative continuation address. So if this expression E1 somehow raises any exception, then we continue, well, assuming that in this E1 there is not again a try block inside, then we continue at this address A here. Well, and at address A, we have to emit code for this expression E2, and then, well, we just have to perform this slide 1. Why this slide 1? Well, once we have executed this expression E2, the result is on top of the stack, but we have also allocated space for this variable x, which we then have to clean up, so we perform a slide 1. What I didn't tell you so far, well, if we again have a look at this beast here, we have a restore B. Well, what you might have already noticed is that the stack distance is increased after the try macro has been executed by 4. So, well, the try macro, we somehow come up with a new exception frame. Therefore, we have this new 4 additional stack cells, and we have to clean them up in the case that no exception has been thrown. Well, and this is what we actually do by this restore macro, which we will see in a second. And again, this plus 1, it results from this variable x, where we also observe that we here have a row prime, and this row prime is just the old row with the additional binding of x as a local variable to this stack distance plus 1. Well, and that's it actually already for this try clause. So let's have a look how this try macro is implemented. So we have this try A here. And the first thing which we do is we save the old exception pointer on top of the stack. Then we save the global pointer of the current stack frame. Then we save the frame pointer. And then finally, on top of the stack, we save the continuation address of the current of this negative continuation. And then we just have to increase the stack pointer, and we have to set the current exception pointer on that one, which points to this negative continuation address. Okay, so that's it, more or less. That's everything which we have to do for our try macro. And then how does a restore look like? Well, we had this restore B. Whoops. This restore B over there. So what we do is we continue at address B. So we have to set the program counter to B. So here we want to continue. And then we have to restore the exception pointer. And this is what we do here. So this one, it first pointed somewhere here into the stack, and then we restore it for the current exception frame, pointing to this one. And then, well, we just have to pop before we actually pop the whole frame, we save the value which we have computed here. So this is this A. We save it then here on top of the stack, and then we can pop these 4 cells which we introduced for this exception frame. So this means we have completely popped this whole exception frame from our stack, and we can continue with our usual business. Okay, so far so good. What have we done so far? Well, we gave up the current computation context. We restored all the registers, and we now have to hand over the exception value to the exception handler. So that means we have to come up with a code generation scheme for this race instruction. And there, well, again, we first have to perform code for this expression E, so for this right-hand side of this race thing. And then again, we introduce a new macro, this race thing. And how is this one implemented? Well, this instruction now, it somehow does something similar to this restore thing, because, well, in this, maybe I should go back again, in this try instruction, we created an exception stack frame, and in this restore instruction, we popped this exception frame. But in case that an exception is thrown inside this expression E1, it immediately jumps to this label A, and we still have to pop, in that case, our exception stack frame, which we only have done so far in the case that no exception has been thrown. So only here we have removed it. And this pop of this whole exception stack frame is done here by this race instruction. And first of all, what we should do is we shouldn't call this one A, but just a temporary. So you can think of a variable. Well, either, well, it could be a general purpose register or a special variable which is allocated at the inside this virtual machine. So there we want to save the current value on top of the stack. So we save this value A here inside this variable TMP. And then what do? Well, we restore the stack pointer. So we drop the current exception frame. Then we restore all our registers, this program counter. Well, this one gets the address where the negative continuation address, this was this A. Well, and this was here on the stack. So this is what we firstly do, and then we restore the frame pointer and the global pointer and also the exception pointer. And then, last but not least, what we have to do is we have to assign at the top of the stack the value which has been computed by the race instruction. Well, and that's it. So now we might have a look. Well, just as a quick glance, you might remember. So this was our program, this greatest common divisor thing. And now we want to emit code for that one. So let's jump back. Here we are. So we perform here a call by value thing. And, well, it is a let rec instruction. So we assume that we start with stack distance 0. And therefore, we have to, well, we have exactly one let rec binding. So we have to allocate space for one variable. And then we push this very first one on top of the stack, and we can already emit code for it. So for this right-hand side. So again, we have to come up for this function with a global vector. So therefore, we have to add this GCD binding, this global variable to our global vector. Therefore, we have this push log 0. Well, why this 0? Why do we have actually in push log 0 here? So we started at stack distance 0. And the question is, why do we have a push log 0 over here? Well, the let rec binding. Well, we have created this variable at address 1. We have just allocated one stack cell. So we have a stack distance of 1 over there. And we know that this GCD is at address 1. So we do stack distance of 1 minus 1 is 0. Okay? So we have push log 0 over there. And then, well, yeah. We have a stack distance of 2, and now nothing special happens anymore. So we do our usual business, which we are already known. We do this make vector instruction, which creates this global vector. Then we perform this make fun in order to create this function object. And we say that the function, the code for it, is at address A. So this one is here. And we actually, well, for this example, it doesn't matter, so we spare us the details of how this code looks like for this particular GCD function. That's not really interesting. What is more interesting, well, after we created the function, then we have to continue with the right-hand side. So we continue here at this label B. Well, and since it is this let rec binding, we have to perform this rewrite. And then we can emit our try code. So here we start with try C. So again, C is the label where we continue if an exception is raised. So this is this one here. And well, in case an exception is raised, we just want to push return the variable. So this was this with z to z, and therefore we have to load the variable on top of the stack. This is done by this push log 0 instruction, and then, well, we have to perform the slide operation where we said because of this with binding of this variable x, we have to pop that one. So this is why we do a slide one over there. So this is in case we have an exception is raised. So let's emit code for the expression which we actually want to execute. So this was this GCD applied to 0 and 5. And yeah, again, we have to emit code from right to left of the arguments. So first what we do is we load the constant 5, we perform a make basic instruction, then the first parameter, this is this load constant 0, and again we perform a make basic over there, and then we have to load the GCD variable, and this is, again, it is at address 1, so if we have stack distance 10 here, 10 minus 1 gives us 9, so we perform a push log 9 there. And then we can already apply it. Well, and once the function has been applied, well, we said that we jump to this label D. So here we continue, and well, if we actually jump to this label D, this means we no exception has been raised. So everything went smoothly and fine, but then we have to clean up our exception frame. So this is why we have this restore here. And after this restore, after we have popped the exception frame, we continue with our normal stuff. So this is continuation address E, and we had a let reg binding of one variable. So finally, we just have to come up with a slide one. And well, we can have a sanity check here. We have a stack distance of 2. So if we remove one stack cell, then we have exactly one thing on top of the stack. So this is the value which we receive by evaluating the whole expression. Okay. This was the small example. Do you have questions so far? Okay. So let's get back here. So if we have a look at this thing, what we actually observe is that, well, this is more or less the semantics which also Java has. So there is not much of a big difference here. But can you think of in C++, is this also there the same, or is it there more complicated? In C++, so in Java, again, it's more or less the same semantics. We have this tries, we have this restores things, nothing special over there. So in C++, what are the biggest differences? Probably multiple inheritance, but, well, this doesn't play a role here. What else do we have in C++ compared to Java? We don't have a garbage collector. In Java, we don't deallocate things, so this is done by the garbage collector, but in C++, this is kind of important. So we have to deallocate things. And once we pop a stack frame, we might have to call the deconstructor. So if you have constructed somewhere an object in the stack frame, then we have to deallocate it. Therefore, the compiler has to emit code for that one too. So here, this is much more simpler because, again, we have a garbage collector for free here. So then, well, let's continue. So this is, well, what we have talked about so far is somehow related to this OCaml language. And in OCaml, exceptions might be also raised by the runtime system. As for example, well, if you do a division by zero, then an exception is thrown. And, well, what we here observe is that these exceptions, they can be, again, of any type. And you as a programmer, you can come up with arbitrary algebraic data types, and you can extend them as you want to, and you can throw these as an exception. And, well, what we haven't also done for the sake of simplicity, in OCaml, you can perform pattern matching on these exceptions. So, for example, you can do some match E1 with and assume that the result type of this expression E is an integer, then you can just check, is it a 0, perform something, or is it a 1, perform something. This is what we have left out so far. This is just for the sake of simplicity. Well, actually, you can somehow simulate it. You could do try E with, and then you have this X thing, and then you could perform a match X with, and then say, for example, the empty list or the non-empty list. So, well, as a programmer, you probably don't like this because you have to write a lot. So, in languages like OCaml, you of course you have such fancy features. And there we also observe that if the pattern matching is not exhaustive, so for example, again, we match for integers, and here we just matched for the integer 0 and 1. If the exception would be a 5, then the exception is again rethrown. So this is something more complicated, which we also left out here, because, well, this more or less, well, not more or less, this behaves like a catch-all clause. So, you know, OCaml, you would just have either this underscore thing, or again, you just bind it to a variable if you want to have this catch-all clause. Okay. Yes, so this is one interesting question. We say that exceptions only make sense in call-by-value languages and not for call-by-need languages. Why? Why doesn't it make sense to have them? Ah, yes. Exactly, that is the problem. The closure, well, this means it, the expression itself might not be evaluated, and then, well, maybe this closure is handed downwards in our stack, and the actual exception stack frame is popped, so it's gone, and we don't have our continuation addresses anymore. So, well, we are lost in that sense. So here, for these call by need languages, it doesn't make sense to have these exceptions. Well, of course, you can somehow simulate these exceptions. Well, if you think of, you could always have for each expression, you could have something like an option type where you return it. Or you return a tuple where you say the first thing is either it is an expression, an exception or nothing. And then you can somehow, well, I think this is somehow how Haskell, a programmer, would do it. They built these monads and are happy with that. So you could somehow simulate this exception thing also there. But if you want to keep it like this here, or how it is done in our virtual machine, where we perform all the operations on the stack, then it doesn't make sense to have this for call-by-need languages. Okay, so far so good. So we are done with the functional part of this lecture. So we now dive into a new topic. So we now have a look at logical programming languages. And for that, well, I think the most popular one is Prolog. And again, we don't want to support the whole Prolog language. We just want to make use of a simplified version, which we call Prol, the Prolog Lite. And there, well, what do we actually omit? This is, first, we omit arithmetic, so we don't want to add or subtract some things. And then, well, at least in the first few slides, we want to omit the cut operator. So in Prolog, it's all about checking the state space, so checking every possibility. And by the cut operator, this is a neat operator where the programmer can tell the compiler or the virtual machine not to execute certain search paths. So this makes it faster. Otherwise, you easily get this combinatorial exploitation of checking all the possible paths, but by this cut operator, you can say, no, you don't have to search in that or that direction. So first we keep it out, this cut operator, and at the end we will introduce it again. What we also don't do are this self-modification of programs. So like in Java, where you have this reflection API, in Prolog, you can also self-modify these programs and write dynamically your own predicates by these assert and retract statements. This is something which we will completely wipe out of this lecture. We don't want to make use of that. Okay, so let's start with an example here. Well, first we will have a look at the syntax, how Prolog, of which Prolog makes use. And here we have a predicate called bigger, and there we have some atoms. So we have an atom elephant, we have an atom horse, and the first thing which we should observe here is that small letters, these are just atoms. So it's like you write a 5 in Java or so. So this is an atom. Whoops. Sorry for that. Again, these are atoms. And by these atoms, you can then define a predicate here, or you can also come up here where you say you define this predicate is bigger by referring to this predicate bigger. And, well, this double colon and this hyphen, this should remind you of an implication. So this is something like that. So if the right one holds, so if bigger of x comma y holds, then also is underscore bigger should hold for x and y. And, well, what else do we observe? We have this colon here, and this colon is like the logical end. So that means we have now defined this bigger and is bigger predicate, and then, well, in Prolog, we have this syntactic thing, this question mark and this hyphen, and then you can actually ask Prolog, does the following thing hold? And here we just have this is bigger elephant dog. What else? Well, actually, this dots at the very end, we don't really need them. So in this lecture, we will make use of the following syntax. We omit the full stops here. Whoops. We omit all the full stops here. This is what we don't make use of. And then, well, we have this arrows like this one. So again, this should remind you as an implication. And then we just have this question mark. So these are the slightly different things. And what else do we have? Well, here we have for our predicates, we allow, at least in Prolog, allows us to write these atoms directly in this left-hand side of this predicate. This is something which we don't allow. So here, our left-hand sides, we always have these variables, and again, these variables are capital letters. And then, in order to express the same semantics, we just have to say that X has to be an elephant, or in the terms of prolog, X and elephant unifies, and similarly, Y unifies with horse. Why do we do this? Well, this allows us somehow to have a normalization of the left-hand side. So we know that these right-hand sides, they all always look the same, and it makes it easier for our translation schemes. But the semantics is the same. But it's easier if you have a normalized view on them. Okay, so, with Prolog, you cannot only do these more or less boring things, but you can also do more or less real programming. Well, not more or less, you can do real programming. And here we have a function up, which just appends the two lists. And here we have as input the list X and the list Y, and as output we have then the list Z. And how is it implemented? Well, we have our first clause here. So if X is the empty list, then Y and Z have to be the same. Well, if we append the empty list to Y, and the append function should return the appension of X and Y, then Z has to be equal to Y. And otherwise, we decompose the first input list, this X, and there this has a similar syntax as we have known from our functional programming language, where we somehow can do a pattern matching here. Well, so this is the head of the list, this is this H, and this X prime, this is the tail of the list. So in Prolog, you write it like this, then you have this one, and then you have again a closing bracket. If you want, so if this is the head, and this is the tail of the list, this somehow you would write it in a functional language like X double colon XS. Okay, this is how we would do it in a functional language. I don't know why they decided this syntax, but that's what we have to deal with. So this means we extract the head of X, and we check if the head of Z is also the same head as of X, and then we recursively call the app predicate with X prime, Y, and Z prime. Okay? So this is how we would define a function in Prolog, by making using of a predicate. So maybe this is easier to read in the real Prolog syntax. So in real Prolog syntax, what you would say is if you append the empty list to some list Z, then the result should be also the Z, the same list. And otherwise, if you have a non-empty list here, so you have an element H, and you have a list Y, then the resulting list should be such that the head of the resulting list should be the same, and then you just have to check if X prime and Z prime are the same. Okay, so let's switch back again. This is the same thing in our syntax, but maybe a little bit harder to read here But again, you just need to get used to this one. Okay, so let's do it. So we have asked Prolog, does there even exist a single solution? Or you can also ask Prolog to enumerate all solutions. Well, if there are infinitely many solutions, this may take a while, but at least we might ask him if this is satisfiable at all. And here we have a question of the following form. We have a list X. We have a list which contains a Y and a Z. And may this result if we append them in a list of A, B, and Z? So now is the question, is this satisfiable? And if so, if it is satisfiable, what is the actual assignment of X, Y, and Z? Can you think of? So again, we want to concatenate somehow. I write it down in this functional style, so this might be a little bit more familiar to you. Is this satisfiable? So this is the question. Is there some assignment of X, Y, and Z such that this one holds? Any idea? Ah, yes, you're right, but I made a small mistake. So, this one is the right operator. Because X is a list, it's not a list element, but it is a list. So in Prolog, well, Prolog is untyped, so the compiler won't tell you, well, this has this type and this has that type. So for example, in OCaml, if you want to concatenate a list of strings with a list of integers, the compiler would tell you statically, so at compile time, he will tell you, no, this won't work out. This is not correctly typed. But in Prolog, we don't have type inference. So here the compiler wouldn't warn you or would even throw an error. So for this small example, what we find out is, well, a solution would be if we assign X the list just containing A, Y is the list element B, and Z is the list element C. So this is one solution, and it is the only solution. Okay, clear so far? Okay, then we can go on. Well, again, this is the syntax which you can use in real Prolog. And, well, Prolog there, as in more or less every functional programming language, lists are really important, so they are built in here too. And the empty list is given, well, as usual, or as we have known from our functional language, just by this opening square brackets. Then we have this binary constructor for a list application. Again, I write it down. In functional languages, you would have that this looks somehow similar to this one. H is the head of the list, and Z is the remainder of the list. And then, well, they introduced a shortcut, which is, I guess, really, really important. If you want to say that a list has, well, as in this example, at least three elements, then this is a shortcut of this beast. And I think you cannot anymore read it in a reasonable amount of time, this shortcut. Well, first, again, we have this list element A. Then we have to create a new list which contains this B. And then we have to create a list containing this Z. And then the remainder is an empty list. So this is something which you probably don't want to read anymore. So then I have a question for you. Is this the same? So we have a list containing Z. And this one, is this the same? So what do we actually see here? This is a list on the left-hand side containing just one element, this Z. And what do we have on the right-hand side? Well, that's actually also just one element in this list. This is this Z. And then afterwards, we just have the empty list. So yes, indeed, these both expressions, left and right-hand side, are the same. It looks strange, but it is the same. So, well, as a small exercise, well, we might have a look at something else. So we have this atom A, then we have this atom B. And we ask ourselves, is this the same? Is this the same? Is this unifiable? So first of all, is it satisfiable at all? Well, if not, then we can give up immediately. And otherwise, we might find an assignment for a Z which satisfies this equality. No idea. Okay, then I might ask you, what is written on the right-hand side? What do we have there? Exactly. That's the difference, and therefore it's not satisfiable. Here, on the right-hand side, this set is a list element. And here on the left-hand side, we say that this set is a list. If it's the empty list, or if it is a list of things in there, so it's the non-empty list, doesn't matter, but it is definitely a list. And therefore, the left-hand side and the right-hand side is not the same. Again, it looks kind of weird, and it takes some time to get used to this syntax. But that's prologue, I think, to this whole style. It takes some time to get used to it. Okay, and I think that's it for today. Tomorrow there will be no lecture, so we will continue next Monday. Do you have questions so far?
I have one question. Yeah. On the tutorial last time, when there was a free Thursday, we had a tutorial on Wednesday, but this week it would make sense to have a tutorial.
Yes, we don't have an extra exercise sheet so far. Yeah. So this tutorial for this week, we will skip that one too. So we will do this next Thursday. Yes, yes, yes. There is already, On Thursday, you will get a new exercise sheet. Okay? Further questions? Okay, then see you next Monday.